historic feats, historic achievements, in people who had a vision and made those visions reality. One such vision was flying around the world nonstop, non-refueled, solo. Today you saw the Virgin Atlantic Global Flyer arrive at Oshkosh, its first public appearance, to share that feat, that historic aircraft, and the trials and tribulations of accomplishing that mission is an honor for all of us. Tonight, let's welcome the pilot, the visionary who made that all possible, Steve Fawcett. Steve?
Well, I got to show you something first. Let's see if I can find it here. Okay. Got to get this started here. Actually, this isn't the Virgin Global Flyer, but I just have to tell you about this flight we did earlier this month because it was such a neat project. This is a Vickers Vimy. Our mission was to recreate the first transatlantic airplane flight, which was done by John Alcock and Arthur Whitten Brown in 1919. The route was from St. John's, Newfoundland to Clifton, Ireland, and it preceded Charles Lindbergh's much more celebrated flight by 8 years. This Vimy is a replica, except for the modern engines. It's a true replica, and it handles like the original, which is not necessarily good. I had to hang on to the yoke, operate the rudders for the entire 18 hours and 15 minutes of this transatlantic flight. My co-pilot and I had to focus on the instruments because the flight was mostly in instrument conditions. Here we are setting up for the landing in Clifton, Ireland. Actually, there's no airport in Clifton, Ireland. Alcock and Brown landed in a bog and pretty much crashed the airplane. Best we could do is a golf course, Connemara Championship Golf Course. I took great pleasure in calling out my downwind, base, and final to fairway 8. So, here we are coming in for our touchdown on fairway 8 on the golf course. We didn't have a whole lot of faith. You can see the orange spot there. That's our life raft stashed behind the cockpit. And then Mark Revels on the right. We're both wearing our ocean survival suits, and I also assure you each of us was carrying a personal EPIRB in our pockets in case we went down. So we made it, and to the great thrill and enthusiasm of the citizenry of Clifton, Ireland, this is the most excitement that they've had in Clifton, Ireland since 1919, so they said. And it was great because they threw us a parade, sent us on a parade through the downtown of Clifton, and then through a gala party for which was truly inspirational. But I just had to do a little show and tell before I tell you about the Global Flyer. What was we've asked the question: What is the most important thing remaining to be done in aviation? And this is a question which we were discussing at Baron Hilton's Flying Ranch 6 years ago. At that time, Bertrand Picard and Brian Jones had just won the magnificent competition which we had to make the first balloon flight around the world. So we must look for different horizons. Dick Rutan, who was at the dinner, had made the Voyager flight with Jeannie Yeager, now told me that it was possible to make a solo around-the-world airplane flight. This immediately appealed to me because it would be a solo flight, and it would be an aviation milestone. A few weeks later, Dick introduced me to Bert Rutan here at Oshkosh. And Bert did have a concept for the design of a solo round-the-world aircraft. But there were issues that still remained. And one of the issues was that got to have the right engine. The Voyager did it by having two propeller engines. You wouldn't want to do it with just one propeller engine because propeller engines have some reliability considerations. But I wanted the reliability of a jet engine, and I also wanted this to be a speed record when I do the round the world. So we sought a fuel-efficient jet engine. At first, we looked at something that's been developed by the Air Force back in the 1970s, the oil crisis. It's a more fuel-efficient engine, but that was called an F-109 engine, and it was in a box, no potential of any support, and we would have to figure out how to maintain this engine on our own. Then we realized that Dr. Sam Williams, who built Williams International on building a small fan jet engine for cruise missiles. Williams is already making jet engines for small business jets, and he offered the engine currently used in the Citation CJ-2. And I love the idea of getting the reliability, not only of a jet engine, but one that is in current production. The second problem that had to be overcome was an autopilot. Absolutely necessary for a solo flight. And we needed a digital autopilot instead of an analog autopilot, so that it would be more readily programmable for this application. TrueTrack, a very small company in Springdale, Arkansas, it already started making digital autopilots, and maybe some of you have it because it's their primary market is home-built airplanes. This was the solution. This gave us the equipment that we needed to proceed with the development of an airplane. Gale Composites team was sensational on this whole project, and in particular, there's one person, John Karkow, who became the key man in the project. It's an extraordinary example of how an aeronautical engineer can carry a lot of responsibility in a small company. He managed the detailed design, Global Flyer, managed the construction, and became the test pilot. The development of the Virgin Global Flyer was a huge success. The plane demonstrated good flight handling from its very first test flight. The testing program was at Mojave, California, and lasted 10 months, 27 flights, totaling 130 hours. John Karkow did the initial flight testing, then I flew eight of the test flights. There were decisions to make. This airplane is takeoff critical. When the engineers sit down and figure out how much runway will be needed to take off for the full load of fuel, the calculation was 8,000 feet. But would we really know? It wasn't really practical to test this airplane with full fuel. In fact, it's not the kind of thing you want to send another test pilot up to do, because that was my job, to be the ultimate test pilot to fly it for the first time with full fuel. So, Gale advocated that I should start the round-the-world flight at Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California because it has a 15,000-foot runway. I decided on Salina, Kansas, because for the finish of the round-the-world, I wanted to be over land. The Virgin Global Flyer has a glide ratio of 37 to 1 with zero thrust. And with a windmilling engine, it'll glide over 300 miles from its cruise altitude of 45,000 feet. So I could run the risk of running out of fuel anywhere over the United States because I know I could fly a glider to a nearby airport. But if I were finishing the flight in California, because I had started at Edwards Air Force Base, I'd be running the risk of running out of fuel between Hawaii and California, and that could be deadly. With the decision of Salina, I got this 12,300-foot runway, which had recently been resurfaced. In addition, I got the use of an old Strategic Air Command hangar, and the unequivocal support of everybody in Salina, including the Aviation School of Kansas State University. Kansas State designated 7 aviation maintenance students who are already held their A&P mechanics credentials to assist the scaled crew led by Philip Grasso. K-State also provided named 4 students from their professional pilot program, shown here with me and my wife. The pilot students worked directly with me and the mission control director, Kevin Sass, in the flight planning and simulation of tailwind scenarios, so they were directly involved in this project. My meteorologist, David Dienau from Belgium, who had been my assistant meteorologist on my round-the-world balloon flight, tracked the jet streams and turbulence beginning in mid-January. Finally, the desired weather pattern was found for a launch on February 28th. The Global Flyer was fueled to its maximum takeoff weight of 22,100 pounds. That's an unprecedented fuel fraction of 83%. The remaining 17% of its weight was the airplane and me. The previous highest fuel fraction was 72% on an airplane, which was the Voyager. With Virgin Atlantic on hand as a title sponsor and Sir Richard Branson being right there and personally involved in this project all the way, this was really showtime. Patiently, I would have to wait through the afternoon of February 28th because there's over 20 knots of wind, and I didn't want the turbulence associated with that wind. So as the sun went down, I was ready to take off and the wind died. Scale performance engineer Clint Nichols was in the tower making call-outs of speeds at each taxiway intersection. I was briefed beforehand on the required speeds at each point that would be necessary in order to get to the airborne before the end of the 12,300-foot runway. Uh-oh, I just lost my slides again. Okay, hope someone will come up here and get me going here again. I'll wait just a minute before we go.
You're listening to EAA Radio, the sound of air venture.
Taxiway intersection. At the crossing of the first taxiway, I was actually behind the required speed to get off the runway in time, but then the acceleration improved to my great relief, and I was off the ground exactly 8,000 feet, as the engineers had predicted in the preliminary design of the aircraft. My initial climb to 39,000 feet seemed quite normal, but upon crossing into Canada, a message blared in my earphones. GPS failure. Well, this could certainly be a showstopper because GPS is my only form of navigation. It turns out that there was an incompatibility between the GPS software, which was based on the new WAAS system, the Wide Area Augmentation System, and my flight management system. This incompatibility wasn't observed before, and was only observed when you leave the United States. After 2/10 hours, though, I crossed the border. After I crossed into Canada, the GPS automatically readjusted to the older system. There's dangers on this flight that we really don't often like to talk about. This is a pressurized airplane, so oxygen is only needed in case of depressurization. Unfortunately, my oxygen control had an unguarded switch, which was located at the entry of the aircraft. So I must have bumped that emergency oxygen switch while climbing in or moving equipment around at the start of the flight. When I checked in the morning, there was no oxygen left in the bottle. So the stakes of this flight had just gone up dramatically, because a single-engine jet means that's your only source of pressurization air, which means if the engine fails, I would have no oxygen. So in jets, we practiced emergency defense. Put on the oxygen mask and pull out the speed brakes and dive to a safe altitude. Global Flyer doesn't have speed brakes, doesn't even have flaps. And so slick that it would take a very long time to slip down to a survivable altitude, like 25,000 feet. So this was the sobering thought. So the flight continued across the Atlantic and North Africa. Here I am over Morocco. And joined the powerful subtropical jet stream in Egypt, which would boost my ground speed by about 100 knots until I got beyond Hawaii. Sensational jet stream. But about halfway into the flight, they broke the bad news to me. I'd lost a large amount of fuel and probably would not be able to make it to the finish. Thoughts started to cross my mind of the complications of that would result in having to land someplace like, well, I thought of Hong Kong, Nagasaki, Honolulu. But most of all, it would be a disappointment of not being able to complete this flight. Virgin Global Flyer has 13 fuel tanks and a very sophisticated fuel management system. However, the probes in the tanks are famously inaccurate, and the totalizer, which calculates the fuel that's actually burned, completely failed. So it took a long time for my team to realize what exactly had happened to my fuel, why I didn't have enough fuel. They finally determined the amount of missing fuel was 3,100 pounds. That's a huge amount when you consider the total capacity of fuel of 18,000 pounds. And this airplane originally was designed only to make it around the world with 1,000 pounds of reserve. Well, we now know what happened. The largest tanks, the booms, have their fuel vent exit here, shown on this slide, on the engine pylon. This was an unfortunate choice of design. It was intended to reduce wind resistance by not having a fuel vent sticking out in the airflow. But when the tanks are close to full, the vent line would fill up with fuel. When that happens, the fuel is pushed out the fuel vent as the air expands with altitude. And that's part of it. But the other part of the fuel problem was that you have return fuel, that is fuel that goes to the engine that is not burned and continues to circulate back into the fuel tanks. This is a larger part of fuel. But because the tanks were then had pressure on them, because there was air pressure in the tanks, that return fuel did not return into the tank, but also forced out out the fuel vent. So the fuel that I lost, 3,100 pounds, was lost in the second and third hours of the flight. It was streaming out at a rate of 4 gallons a minute over Canada. But when enough fuel was gone to create an air bubble through the boom tanks and the inboard wing tanks, the fuel system worked normally. Anyhow, by good fortune, we had a very good forecast for winds. And nevertheless, so by the time I'd gotten halfway across the Pacific, I was confident that I had enough fuel to make it back to Kansas. The average tailwind on my global flight was 72 knots, and the airplane design was based on having 50 knots of tailwind around the world. Fortunately, I was flying on the best wind forecast of the season. We have now put new fuel vents, and this is from a recent test flight. You see these posts sticking up out of the booms. And the fuel fuel loss problem should not recur. You're probably wondering what it was like flying the Global Flyer. The cockpit was generally well organized. Some of the instrumentation is common to other jet aircraft. Much of it was unique. On the left are the gauges and fuel transfer switches, actually quite a sophisticated system. In the center is the Chelton flight management system, which is as sophisticated as you might find in other jet aircraft. to the rider, the autopilot, and the flight recorders. The seat was big enough to shift around, and I would recline if I desired. I never reclined the seat, however, because I wanted to have immediate access to all the information and controls. I did sleep, but in a very controlled manner. We had an extensive alerting system for things like changes in altitude, pressurization, engine function, and speed. I would also set a countdown timer so I wouldn't oversleep. You can see here in this slide, I was wearing plug-type earphones, which were left over from my race car driving days. And I had to wear these all the time because this is the way I would hear the alarms. The most common alarm was airspeed, which is triggered by any change of 3 knots in airspeed. There were actually a total of 4 nights of flying. This is because even though it's a 67-hour flight, that's flying eastbound around the world. In two of those 4 nights, I did not sleep at all. That is the first and the last night. And the other 2 nights, I took frequent naps of 1 to 5 minutes. So my total sleeping time was about 1 hour for the entire flight. That sounds outrageous, but it is interesting how much value you get out of taking naps. And this seemed to work. I felt good all the way up to landing. But when I went to the victory party that night, I didn't feel so good. You're probably wondering, so I'll tell you that about all these other things, you know. Peeing's really easy. You know, you just take a take 1 liter bottles, and then I could empty those out actually through a fitting through the pressure hull. But you know, the prospect of number two was a very disturbing thought. Yeah. 3-day flight. So to minimize the risk, I went on a low residue diet for 3 days before the flight, and then a liquid diet during the flight. My food during the flight was a total of 12 cans of Slim Fast diet milkshakes. As a precaution, my aviation doctor supplied me with what the hospitals call fecal containment bags, which, well, you can just kind of stick them on. I did get the urge on the third night, and after struggling to get everything ready, I finally decided I really didn't have to go that bad after all. So, once I was assured that I had sufficient fuel, it was clear flying. But notice some things about this route. When in the center of the United States at the start point, I flew northeast to Newfoundland, Canada. And this is may not seem entirely logical, but everything was based on trying to reduce the vulnerability of this airplane while it was fully loaded with fuel. This airplane fully loaded with fuel can only survive 2 G's of load. Actually, when it's empty, it can survive 4 G's. So what this meant was that I had to avoid any significant turbulence, and there's often turbulence associated with jet streams. So I flew away from the jet streams in the early part of the flight until I burned down some fuel. That's why I went up to Newfoundland, Canada. Once I got back down in the middle of the Atlantic, then I got into the smooth air and wanted to be in the jet streams. You'll also notice a big zigzag where I went beyond Hawaii off route. This diversion was to add length to the route. To qualify as an official round-the-world record, a flight must have the length of the Tropic of Cancer, which is 22,880 statute miles. I could declare waypoints. I pre-declared 49 waypoints around the world, which would give me that required, exactly that required length. And I was required to overfly each of those waypoints. Then, so after making it back to the United States, then came the good part. I was over Alamosa, Colorado, which is 400 miles from the finish line, pulled the throttle to idle and started a final glide to Salina, Kansas. There's one more problem. When I turned the switches, when I got close to Salina and I was ready to put the gear down. Nothing happened. Well, then the two main gear came down, and the lights went on, but the nose gear would not. Now, we knew from testing that nose gear was a little slow when it was cold, and it was really cold after this flight. But this certainly would be a shame to finish the global fire flight by coming in on main gear and scraping away the nose of the airplane. So I turned north away from Salina to deal with a problem. First, I tried to slow the aircraft down to get the gear door open with little wind resistance. But the gear lowers forward. So after the gear door was open, I took it up to maximum, you know, redline speed in order to pull the nose gear down. After a long 10 minutes, I finally succeeded and announced three greens. So I proceeded to land. He saw the approach, and here I am coming in for the touchdown. And the rollout, and a tremendously enthusiastic crowd in Salina, Kansas, came out to see this beautiful airplane. And here they are. They've had to go around and visit with all of them. It was a great experience. The results of the flight were very satisfying. Guinness Book of Records was on hand to deliver a certificate for the first solo nonstop airplane flight around the world. Fédération Aéronautique Internationale is the official certifying organization for aviation world records. And there are seven absolute world records for airplanes. So my time for this flight was 67 hours. And allowed me to gain the not only the first solo nonstop airplane flight, but also the absolute world record for speed around the world. This is the first time one of the seven absolute world records had been broken in almost 19 years. The last, again, was Dick Rutan, Gina Yeager, and Voyager. Also broke two of the jet-only records that were held by the big guys. The distance without landing was previously held by a B-52 flying from Okinawa to Spain. Also, the distance over a closed course was held by an Antonov freighter at 12,500 miles. So it's hard to predict the influence this flight will have, if any. But this airplane is interesting because it's close to the mainstream of aviation. It's jet powered, and it places a premium on fuel economy. It demonstrates the advantages of lightweight carbon construction, where the airline industry is still lugging around aluminum airframes. The flight was an adventure, you know, which I wanted to do regardless of the benefits to aviation. In fact, many of the most influential flights in the early decades of aviation were also adventures, yet they were the flights that demonstrated new thinking and development in air travel. So I know why I did this flight. It wasn't any effort to become a celebrity, which will never fit me, but to make an achievement which I can be personally proud of. I've been encouraged by the enthusiasm of people everywhere, many of them who have recognized the essential character of the effort, the persistence, risk, and the importance of building a strong team, and the technology of planning this flight were what was most interesting. For those that have thought that all the major adventures have been done, you know, I hope that I've shown that there are many great projects to take on. And I, for one, will set new goals and be looking forward to coming years. And thank you. Sharing the enthusiasm with me. That's really important to me. And we saved a little time. I bet somebody can come up with a question. Maybe more than one person. Do you have someone with a microphone?
Sure do.
Okay.
We'll be in these two aisles. Come on down.
First question, here.
Thank you. Mr. Fawcett, you're quite an inspiration to most of us, I think. Are you ever going to write a book about your philosophy and what drives you?
Well, in fact, I'm working on a book. This is hard work. And it's slow in coming because it's... Yeah, I'm so involved in trying to do projects, I have a hard time sitting down to write or to, and I rarely give speeches. So, you know, my priority is on doing these things, and I do hope to fit in some time, though, to get it down on paper, because the story I like to tell is that I'm doing these things, but I would like people to figure out that there actually is a message that it's surprising what we are capable of doing as individuals. That yeah, my abilities are not remarkable, and that that I'm doing these things because I've decided to try to figure out how to do them, and persisted, and took the initiative to go out and do them. And I think I'm hoping that some other people will find the same thing, that they will try to do something, not obviously not the same thing that I'm trying to do, but try to do something in their own life.
Hi, I'm Bill Gardner, and I'm over here, and I did something not quite as dramatic, but I sailed solo in a 23-foot sailboat across the Gulf of Mexico, and you know, I had some time to myself to think about things, and I was often thinking, well, I wasn't in really contact with a lot of people. I was in contact with no one, actually. And I was thinking, well, you probably were in contact with people during your flight, but what were some of your thoughts by yourself up there on this voyage?
The I wasn't lonely, first of all. It's a reasonable workload flying an airplane solo. When you have two pilots, it might get boring. If I had the right amount of work to do, flying the airplane, the communications, the navigation, and then trying to fix a couple things too. So I was actually thinking more about how enjoyable this is. I mean, I was flying over continents and oceans. And I would just look at the maps and say, this is marvelous, just to be traveling around the world.
Sir, I presume the airplane had a pilot relief tube. How often in the period of time that you were in the air did you need to use it?
Oh, every 30 minutes. No, it was, so I would just, the trouble with the pilot relief tube is that it's a little bit cold up there. I was flying mostly 45,000 feet, and my high spot was 50,000. And so I didn't want to use this pilot relief tube repeatedly because it just frees solid. So I would save up bottles and then all at once pour them out of the airplane. System worked.
Did you run into any problems flying over China?
In fact, no. You may recall when we were all trying to do Richard Branson and the other contenders in around-the-world balloon flight, China was a big blockage. And some of it flew over China anyhow. But China absolutely refused to grant permission to balloons. However, China does grant permission for airplanes to fly over, and the distinction is that airplanes can stay on the airways and balloons cannot. So they made me work pretty hard over China. My hardest working country on the Virgin Global Flyer flight, because the they had me flying, reporting repeatedly at each waypoint along the way, whereas in the other areas of the world, I was able to have my mission control center make the reports on my behalf.
Hi. I wanted to know if you planned on going to space, maybe one of the private ships or something like that in the future.
Well, that would be exciting. We'll have to keep our eyes open on that. You know, you never want to count anything out.
I admire so much your achievement. Do you have any next challenge you are potentially thinking about?
Next challenge? Well, in fact, we do have a next challenge. Richard, you're here, aren't you? Oh, yes, here you are. I'm blinded by the light. Sir Richard, he has a bit of a flair for things, and we've been talking.
First of all, it's lovely to be up here with Steve, and just been incredible to got to know him over the last few years, and been with him on one magnificent balloon trip. His calmness, his knowledge, his friendship, is a great person to be with. Right, so he's done this wonderful trip around the world with this beautiful plane. And the next thing for the plane to do is to go into the Smithsonian. But somehow it shouldn't go into the Smithsonian yet, because he didn't achieve everything possible that plane could achieve. And so he's going to have one more flight with it in February or March of this year, and he's going to break a whole lot more records. But do you want to explain what you're going
to do? Yes, Richard, that's exactly
it. If you think going around the world's enough,
well, we're pilots, and we want to fly the best that we can, and of course, this is, I was very happy with this flight, no doubt about it. But here we've built this plane, the Virgin Global Flyer, and it has the capability of flying farther than any airplane nonstop that has ever been built.
Full balloon?
Yes, in fact, farther than a balloon has flown ever. And I do.
By the way, don't tell anybody about what he's about to say, because we've got a press conference at 9:30 in the morning.
So, in fact. I also have the ambition that this, the Smithsonian at the Hazy Center, Dulles Airport, has requested this airplane as a contribution, and I intend to give it to them. But, it's tough to put this airplane into a museum when it hasn't been flown to its capability. And I'd always feel bad if I pass that up. So, here we go. We're setting up to do a flight. Yes, it'll be around the world. We haven't firmly decided on the takeoff point or the landing point. But give you an example. So we'd start in Salina, Kansas, and I would go around the world. And when I come to Hawaii, well, instead of going back to Kansas, just go shoot across Mexico and Puerto Rico, and on to the Africa, and then go up to. London or Toulouse, France, for a finish. This would be a substantial improvement over the current absolute record for distance, which, Dick Rutan, Jeannie Yeager, and the Voyager. It would be an improvement of over 4,000 miles over their record. Richard and I have just agreed in recent days to do this, and all the other sponsors of my project, Williams Engines, and all the others who have helped me so much on this project, they also have agreed that we should do this. And so we are now, as of now, starting to make preparations. The ready date will be January 15th. The best jet streams, though, probably are in the month of February and do extend into March. So it's preparation time now for a big flight.
So this means just 70 hours without sleep now.
It's going to be fun.
Anyway, good luck. And,
okay.
Hey. See you at 9:30 in the morning.
Okay, great. And thank you. Thank you so much for your interest.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to join us right here, so we can get a few pictures. So, right there. Give you one last chance to see these two amazing gentlemen. More aviation history made here at EAA Air Venture Oshkosh 2005. Thank you very much for joining us tonight at Theater in the Woods. Have a nice ride home or walk home if you're going to the campground. Let's give a big round of applause to our guests tonight and enjoy the remainder of EAA Air Venture Oshkosh 2005. Thanks for coming this evening.
This is Mike Melville. When I'm not on the edge of space, I'm on